good bottle of Rainwater Madeira. I don't know if that's how it's pronounced, but it says, quote, "This beautiful and lushly forested Atlantic island was discovered in 1419. Named for the Portuguese word for wood, Madeira produces some of the world's most unusual wines." It was discovered that the long, hot journey to the Indian Ocean improved the wine remarkably, and the return trip made it even better. A new style of wine was born. Madeira, so named in the 18th century because it is as soft as rainwater and the color of straw, glistening after a shower of rain.
Wow.
So they tried really hard on that freaking advertising right there. Also, the bottle just feels like something Hemingway.
It does, and it has that size, too.
Yeah, you just put it right there. And although he claimed he never drank while he wrote.
Right.
Which I find very hard to believe, but...
Maybe? I mean, did he drink before and after he wrote?
He claimed that his system was he would only drink in the evenings and never after dinner.
Weird.
Yeah, very interesting. I could see how it would keep you from, you know, becoming addicted.
That's true.
Or getting drunk.
Yeah, you
know,
really wouldn't.
It's an interesting system.
All right, well,
cheers.
Cheers.
We do not own any of the rights to this wine. Please don't sue us. It's very good. We're just aficionados.
Episode 13. Welcome back to Narratives in Philosophy. Today we will be discussing Hume, Enlightenment values, a little bit of epistemology, as we always do, challenging assumptions, perception as powerful tools for system building, and perhaps other things. That's just our little quick noted titles for today.
Yeah, things that we may or may not hit but want to get around to.
Yes.
So, Hume to me, I remember when we read him, was a slap in the face.
Hmm.
Perhaps it was because he discretized so much of his stuff too much.
Ah, yes.
He would specifically discretize the human person, but I guess the first thing to talk about before we can talk about that is what Hume was.
Right.
I think he's one of the empiricists.
That's correct.
No. Which means that he defined matters of fact as matters that must be experienced. And that, to me, is interesting in the scope of human history. And that's my first question, is where does logic fit into that?
Yeah,
because logic can take you beyond yourself, right?
Right. If experiences is the only matter of fact, then we do have a bit of a weird situation. Because experiences in and of themselves, you could say, don't really provide any useful information.
Yeah.
It's only our analyzing, our thinking about, our post-processing of these experiences that we kind of integrate them into ourselves and change our behaviors because of that.
Yeah. And that's what I see in European history. Prior to Hume, you have the scholastic ideal, you have the Renaissance ideal, and people hypothesizing that something is true, but they can't perceive it. They can't directly perceive that the sun is what we rotate around.
Right.
We just know that it has to be true. We didn't experience that until the 60s.
Right.
When we left the planet.
Hmm.
So if you're Hume, in my mind, you're a flat... Well, no, you're not a flat earther. You're a geocentric person for a very much longer time than most of us. So I don't, right away out the gate, I don't like you. I'll make that very
clear.
Yeah,
I recall in our book club discussion, we read, what was it called?
Seneca.
We read Seneca and Hume. Hume's book, I have it right here. The Treatise of Human Nature. That's right.
Yeah.
Which was effectively a anthropological examination from philosophy of the parts of human. Very anthropological intrinsically there. There were sections called of the understanding, of the passion, of the morals. It struck most of us as very arbitrary, very dense, impressive, but questionable in application.
Extraneous structure.
Yeah, potentially. And we'll get to that topic as well.
Yeah, so that's the thing. It was somewhat disunified. He broke broke it down into a million tiny perceptions. Like, the passions are doing their own data gathering. What's the other thing he set up against? Oh, the reasoning faculty is doing its own data gathering, and he combined both of those into something he called an impression.
Right.
Both of those two things give us an impression.
It does just seem really arbitrary to me as well.
Yeah, because the entire basis of his thing is that he's an empiricist and things have to be experienced.
Right.
How is he experiencing these things?
Yeah. It's more like he built structures in his head. He divided things in a kind of, air quotes, scientific way, but didn't necessarily have a reason to divide them in that particular way,
no.
Except for maybe his own experience, except for maybe how he just perceived the world.
But then the question is there anything better than perception?
And that is exactly what we ask. Like, can you do better than Hume? That's more of a hard question. Implicitly, my answer is yes. I think we've actually gotten there in some of the... maybe... perhaps some of this podcast episodes, but more so in some of the book clubs, we have delineated ideas that are more philosophically grounded, more fundamental than Hume. And I think this idea of being philosophically grounded is a very modern one, because you don't really get it from ancient philosophers. You don't get it from, you know, Enlightenment philosophers either. I think it is something that has to be modern, because I don't know where the concept comes from, really.
So then what is this grounding?
Yeah,
what
is
it supposed to look like?
So there's a couple things. There's the technical, like, metaphysical grounding that's discussed in kind of academic philosophy circles, and it's related to some problems we've talked about. But regardless, that I don't think that's quite what I mean when I say it's not philosophically grounded. I think being philosophically grounded is a linking between an idea or a structure back to the, what's
the
it even called?
Experience is
it's not experience,
life.
No. Back to, like, a mathematical basis, a real fundamental, right?
Something that is very, so obvious.
Well accepted, well proven.
Almost like an a priori.
Yeah, you have to draw that line from these a priori's or these fundamentals up to your philosophical structure in order for them to be grounded.
So
that's what I'm getting at.
Hume and the ancient philosophers and the medieval
they didn't do that.
Didn't feel, well, maybe because it was implicit.
And they didn't feel concerned to do that.
Because it was sort of kind of assumed thing.
It's also possible that I just think they didn't do it. But as far as they were concerned in their day with the a priori's that they brought to the table, maybe they did do them, and they did it just fine as far as anyone there was concerned.
So, what's the difference between an a priori and an assumption of something being true? Because that's the thing. Today we're in the situation where Hume and other thinkers have allowed us to simply point out what people are doing and say, that's not an a priori truth. That's your own bias and assumption.
Yeah.
What's the difference? Like, how do we even know? And that's the problem, because Hume...
we're coming from these different perspectives, these different worldviews, these different starting points.
And that's what I put here, is that if you think of things the way Hume thinks of things, you can break things down to an infinite level. Who's to say that you need to stop at passions and reasoning faculties?
Yeah.
We could keep going.
We could. And... just to give our listeners a bit of idea of what Hume worked through in this book, Treatise on Human Nature, there was basically three sections. There's of the understanding, of the passions, of the morals, like I've already said.
Yeah.
In each of those, there were chapters, and each chapter worked towards a subcomponent of what that overall section was talking about. And so, like, for example, in the passions, he might have a chapter on anger, on lust, on, you know... And he would just describe and talk about these individual things. And the way he seemed to view it, the way he put this work... what he claimed for this book was that it was his best attempt. It was his actual labor. Like, he worked very hard on actually figuring out what each of these components were. And he... like, I say actually, I mean that literally. He really thought that this was what humans were. And he broke it down to these discretized components. And that's what really rubs us wrong.
Yeah, that's something I'll point out, is that in England of his day, some people wouldn't publish it. Some people condemned it. Apparently, the Scottish common sense philosophy movement.
Very
hated,
counter Hume, yeah.
Hated Hume. We learned that from the good Mr. McClung. So then the question is, okay, how does all of this stuff Hume comes up with apply? These discretizations, and that was the first question that came to mind, is if we can figure out how this applies, we can decide on its value. Maybe it's not right of me to decide on its value, but because it's such a sweeping epic of a book about human nature, you kind of feel like you have to decide on its value implicitly. So my question was, how would he apply this to the way he interprets history?
Yeah. I kind of have the same question in mind. What is the value of these? One of the things we talked about in that book, club meeting was he seems a bit passionless. He seems a bit removed from the work he's doing, almost like it's a manual, you know? And so when you do think about his writing and think about how does it apply, what does it mean? Like your example, how can you view history through that lens? We come to a crossroads, basically. We could say, well, it gives us a framework, albeit arbitrary, to delineate, to make sense of human actions, and to better understand, because our minds need a actual structure. Our minds need a finite framework to play within. It gives us that structure, even if it is arbitrary, in order to bring that understanding into us.
And he would probably say, it's no more arbitrary than believing in the existence of God.
He would, yeah. And he beyond that, he would probably say, the arbitrariness of it, at least his arbitrary, is born of a lot of work, a lot of effort.
Some perceived reality.
I don't even think he would really consider it arbitrary. Like, I don't really think he would.
It's
now,
kind of obvious.
Yes. It's more like, this is actual. This is implicit. This is right there. So, yeah, without speaking
too much
for him,
yeah.
At the same time, at least we agree it's arbitrary. But I guess from his perspective, I would still argue, even if he did concede of it being arbitrary, he would still say, this actually has a lot of value because it is a framework within which we can understand humans.
And it just seems very utilitarian to me.
That is a utilitarian argument, yeah.
The idea that the only reason we come up with this structure is because what we have right now isn't working. So that's my
right.
Next question is, what exactly was wrong with the system he had up till that time? Because it's not like the time was shoving God down people's throats. You know, obviously Hume was allowed to live. He was not burnt at the stake. So things have improved in Europe to some extent. Protestant Reformation opened that door of inquiry, kicked open the door, and now people can question pretty much anything. Like, maybe I can just interpret God the way I want to. Maybe I can interpret him out of existence. So, you know, you don't have this foundational truth-declaring church. And that's something that I find myself kind of wishing for sometimes. And I wonder if there's something archetypical there. I go back in my mind and I wish that there was this kingly, priestly presence that simply declares what is true.
It's almost like Hume is trying to provide that too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it is, like, we might view it as arbitrary, but at the same time, he, by his own claim, has done the research. He's put the work in. He's found the truth and is now sharing it with us. So in a way, we do want that. We do desire that.
Yeah.
Still
there.
I would link it back to a more base level desire from us humans of wanting to understand how things work, wanting to understand the truth behind, wanting to understand metaphysics, for example. I think that's there. And yeah, if there were some wise sage or benevolent ruler or almighty creator who did have the answers, of course we'd want that from them.
Yeah.
So Hume is kind of filling that position for us, or at least trying to, and we're kind of saying, well, you have to give better answers than that.
So he probably, if he's an empiricist, would he have claimed that ultimately the things he came up with were based upon his five senses?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay. So that's how he defines perception, then. he defines perception as
pretty straightforward. Yeah.
Just simple. Now see, that's what's so interesting, because my entire conception of science is that it takes you beyond your five senses. Yes, you use your five senses to make the initial hypothesis, you use them, but isn't the entire idea that using first principles, you can go beyond yourself?
I think like yes and no. Fundamentally, the actual work that is done is entirely through our senses, but then it's grounded by logic and reasoning. So it's not like it's...
And that's it. Logic and reasoning. Don't those take us beyond us?
They're considered fundamental. That's the thing. They're considered just a 2 + 2 = 4 sort of fundamental. Which, you know, I think that's fair. I don't know that it takes us beyond us. It's just taking us to a common understanding.
I guess then what I'm asking is that if there's a sense that logic can sometimes function as an algebraic equation where you balance the equation and you have the unknown x variable, is there a higher order of logic beyond just the 2 + 2 = 4 to where the unknown variable becomes known because for the equation to be solved, it must be x. It must be this. So like in the syllogism,
okay,
if then else.
Yeah.
We've used that kind of thinking before. I don't know if that's a syllogism, but we've used that kind of thinking before, and that has brought us, as we've said, all the way up to the existential beyond. But essentially what Hume is saying is all of your attempts to get up to the existential beyond, even that, the gap that you have to leap is way wider than you think it is. I take issue with that. I think that the thinking we've done so far has been pretty solid thinking. But from what I'm seeing of Hume, that is not the case. Because we've used almost filling in the unknown variables to get us to that point. Maybe we're being intellectually disingenuous by doing that. Or maybe Hume is being intellectually disingenuous by saying that, oh, you can't fill in those variables to get you up to the existential beyond and take that leap. And for those who are wondering, existential beyond is that moment where you get past the point of empirically experienced phenomena. And then you're dealing with probabilities. But I don't think Hume lets us do that. There's no room for that in Hume's system. It's just simple. The only thing that is true is mathematics in his system. It's the only realm of knowledge that is perfectly certain.
Yeah. I think you're definitely getting at the limits, the flaws, the issues with empiricism. I don't have the knowledge or clarity to put more words to that, to those.
That's why I really think of logic.
It's difficult.
Can logic be used in such a way? You know, that's why the medieval curriculum emphasized the trivium so much, because dialectic, rhetoric,
grammar,
exactly. Dialectic was the thing they would use to get beyond their experience.
Yeah.
Now, of course, they came up with some ridiculous stuff, but, you know, the music of the spheres, we're rotating in these rotating spheres, there's the fixed stars, all these things about cosmology that were hilarious.
Yeah.
But to some extent, I look at the universe, if I'm Galileo, I observe, I use my senses, and I do it in a different way, and it gets me to the conclusion that we must not be rotating. We were not the center, by any means.
I don't know that Hume would have disagreed with Galileo, exactly.
Okay, go ahead. Sure.
Because, you know, you're right. He is using his senses to observe, wait, our understanding is actually wrong about this. Our unfounded belief is wrong. Here is the evidence to show, you know, here's the empirical evidence to show that, you know, it's different from what we think it is. So I guess I'm having a hard time going there exactly with you, because I really don't think Hume would have had a problem with that. I think that the logic employed when shown to Hume, I think it would have been fine with. And that's the hard thing. It's like, I guess I have a hard time really understanding what Hume is countering, what he's fighting against. Why, for instance, did the whole common sense thing oppose Hume? Why did the Scottish common sense movement
have a problem with him?
Have a problem with him as well. I mean, my discreditation of him is effectively that he is extremely arbitrary and he's not doing what he says he's doing with grounding his work in observation. You know, when we have introspection and we look in ourselves, you know, he's somehow calling that observation.
How can you call that observation?
The reality of introspection when it comes to, or even not introspection, but, you know, looking out on society and looking out on things, the reality is that's just one instantiation or some number of instantiations of how humans behave.
Yeah.
You know, it's not actually grounded to anything except this. Much of science is done like that, especially anthropology. You know, you do just observe and then you make some observations. When Hume does it, though, he sets up this system. The systems of understanding, passion, and morals that strikes us as insufficient. You know, it strikes us as, well, there's more to humans than that. So our critique then is somewhere after the observations. Observation's fine. His actual formulation of categories is, I think, where we have fault.
Yeah, and it's almost the Baconian response is that Hume is returning to this quaint, separate from experience. While he claims to be based on experience, he's so separate from it, in that Bacon said, the senses are nothing but to judge of the experiment.
Yeah.
Limit what the senses have to do to judge of the experiment that is used. And that seems more genuine.
Yeah, it does.
That's something we can do. I don't see Hume doing any experience. I don't see Hume doing all these physical things that we can all go out and do today. And if we don't believe Hume, try it out and see for ourselves.
I think that is where he's kind of falling apart in our eyes. It's not repeatable. It's not even stuff where we can follow his train of thought. You know, it's just, here's the answer. Hope you like it.
Here's
I'm a genius.
Passions.
You know? Yeah. These are your passions. You have a finite set of them. There's this one and this one and this one and this one. Make sure you don't have any others or I'm wrong. Like, what?
So, that's the thing. Even the moral assumptions, like the idea that there are morals, it's tough to not see Hume in the Nietzschean vein, even though to some extent some of the stuff Hume was doing was iconoclastic. The idea that this stuff can be based from inside myself and not from some outward authority. Maybe that's the big thing, is what is the importance of the individual in Hume's schematic? I know one thing he says is that reason is the slave of passion. So, that's interesting. We don't have passion at all times. We don't have passion driving us towards our motivations. So to me, that's an animalistic reduction of the human person.
It could be.
You're only driven by a passionate motif.
It could be that we have a differing of definitions when it comes to passion as well. We could maybe even translate that to say something more like reason is the slave of desire or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And then we would have a equivalence statement to basically say you only do what you want to do or you only reason about what you desire. Something along those lines, which would be a little bit less. I mean, that is more of a proven anthropological statement. You do things for a reason. That reason is your passion. Is kind of the lines I would draw there to make that more of an acceptable statement to us.
What's funny about that is that if you take his statement at face value, reason is not as valuable as the people of the past would have held it. You know, the divine light of man's reason.
Yeah.
When Bacon proceeds through his great instauration, the assumption there is that reason has the ability to go forward unadulterated and that people can find the answer.
Yeah.
There are answers, and they can be found. And, you know, that's based on Romans 1, from the Baconian perspective, is that there are eternal attributes out there. There are things that can be observed and experienced. But Hume is like, hey, who's to say that I'm wrong? Because no one really can. So maybe that's why he's able to just arbitrarily proclaim things. Nobody can say he's wrong. We can't say he's right. We don't want to say he's right, but who can say he's wrong?
It just seems so... it's almost reductionist of his views, but you know, I'm inclined to agree with you. It's tough. My only, you know, redeeming value here is just to return to the idea of, well, his system does have value. It is a framework. Maybe it's not perfect, but it's a framework. It's based on observation. Even if we can't follow his reasoning to quite get there, it is still useful. You know, to go back to your idea about how we view history through this, we can conceivably take a character from history and say, okay, they had this passion here, they used this understanding here, you know, they employed these sorts of morals here, and fit it into this framework. And it's more memorable like that, it's more conceivable like that. Is it accurate? No, it's inaccurate to the extent that the model is. But at the same time, at least we have something. That's the only place I can kind of take this back and say there is some redeeming value. You know, empiricism, it was successful in some ways. So I think that's really all I have to redeem Hume for us. And I know even in our book club, we didn't even broach it all that much.
Yeah, because, you know...
For these reasons.
We just didn't see the value of it. But I think something that's powerful about what Hume's doing is he's showing how easy it is for someone to create their own vocabulary and their own dictionary, almost. Yeah. And then they're proceeding on those grounds. And then it's impossible for them to interlocute and discuss with anybody else because have a certain belief about the way things should be.
Now, other people have to work into their framework in order to just engage with them. Yeah, we've obviously had some experience with this.
I had a very interesting discussion with some students. We sat down and we're doing a podcast for our class, Principles of Education, and the first episode was Equity in Education.
Yeah.
And I said, is it possible for humans to agree? Well, they were saying, it's not me. They were putting forward, all of them, as their basis of equity, God created us all in his image.
Mm.
And these are students in a public school. I did not give them this. And I said, well, I will do something called playing devil's advocate now.
Very well.
What if we remove God from the equation? Can we still agree to equity without that foundation stone?
Yeah. That's great.
And one young man says, no, because without that, there's not a common thing for people to agree to. And he said it very simply, but... It's almost as if the currency exchange of faith is the thing that helps people agree to terminology.
Right.
And he was getting at that very deep idea by just saying no, because people can't agree to things. You know, and he said black, white, Hispanic, the one thing they agree to is the existence of a God. That's what he said, and I was like, wow.
Kid knows what he's talking about.
I was like, okay, you are a smart 13-year-old.
Yeah.
But that's interesting. Because we were able to have a discussion, and they have completely different cultures from me. They're separated from me by 20 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think you just aged yourself at 33, but that's okay.
10 plus years.
There you go.
Dang, I was trying to not reveal my age, Jake. So we had discussions, and some of the problems I see in our little microcosm, if you will, is that people have frameworks that they have arbitrarily declared for themselves.
Absolutely.
And have arbitrarily declared this to be so.
Yeah. Oh, man.
So then people won't talk to each other.
Oh, man.
So how do we fix that?
Oh, I knew you were going there.
Because, that's the deal, is if perception is king... Which I'm not saying it's not, but if perception is king, as Hume states it to be implicitly, then what is the purpose of conversation?
All right.
This is like going back to our past episode.
I know. And worse. I have some things in mind. This is tough, man.
All right. Going off the page.
Okay, so there's two. We'll get back on the page, but
okay, this is good.
In a minute. There's basically two things that come to mind here. There's this problem of language and communication,
yeah.
And I view that as a surface level thing.
That can be dealt with.
There's a deeper underlying issue where people latch onto their own thoughts based on their own perceptions and refuse to interchange components of those module thoughts.
So there is something that the perception can interact with that is an ideal metaphysical truth. And they just say, that isn't there. So the perception is all there is. So because of that, this is my truth.
Yes, I'm speaking more of a human behavior sort of thing.
Okay.
Where, you know, in practice, we see this with, just to speak really about topics very pertinent to us, we see this especially in the church. Mm. When people get an idea of what a church is, what a meeting is, what a pastor is, what a teacher is, what an elder is. Is the church supposed to be meeting in a building? How nice is the building supposed to be? How many people constitute a church? What are the activities of church? Is it supposed to be on a Sunday morning? What time? When? Style of music? How much music? How long? Is there childcare? Is there not? You know, I literally could go on for about 10 minutes on this list. I've scratched the surface of the concepts that people affix in their minds and hold firmly onto.
And it's based upon experience.
Entirely experience.
And that's a very empirical belief. Well, I've seen this. It's limited us. I've seen this. It's been ineffective. I've seen this.
And so somehow they lock themselves into this small thing based on their own personal small experience and perception.
Yeah.
Because when it comes down to it, the church itself has interacted in a plethora of ways throughout the years. There's not one right answer. Even to this day, you can go to an Orthodox church across the street from a Baptist church, and you will find the most bizarre differences. And they open the same book. Yes. They just read from the same passage, the same words.
One's plated in gold, one is plated in faux leather.
Absolutely.
Oh, now see, that's really interesting, because this power of perception.
And both point at the other person and say,
wrong.
They're wrong.
And both of them reject data to the contrary.
Yes.
Both of them reject
data. They actually hold their own experience and beliefs in higher esteem than the fact that I just pointed out about church history. Hey, the church has actually met in all these different ways.
Here's one of the interesting things. Both of them take on separate data streams.
That's true, too.
From an Orthodox perspective, they're similar to the Catholic Church, which Catholic takes a couple systems of authority separate from the sola scriptura of the Reformation, which is that martyrs and saints are an authority, theologians are an authority, the Pope, only when he speaks ex cathedra, is an authority, and Scripture is also an authority.
Yeah.
So they have all these data streams, and because of that, they would say, no, I'm not based on perception. I'm based on the fact that these are all data streams.
Well, below that level of data stream, they're still in this system that is their perception. So at some point in their life, they, based on perception, based on conversations with other people, based on going to that church since they were, an infant, based on being baptized as an infant, maybe, they have agreed, based on their perceptions, I just want to say that over and over again, to those data streams. Yes.
Yeah, I could totally agree with that. Like, for me, I have had experiences where I have felt like, all insanity aside, that the Bible is specifically talking to me. And this began in high school. It didn't begin before then. And I began to believe, okay, this is the only data stream that I can accept as evidentiary of any sort of metaphysical truth.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people would say the scientific process of logic is the only thing I can accept as, that's the Sam Harris position, that facts can inform morality.
Yeah. So just to get back to this idea of Hume,
and
we'll continue here. Hume's perceptions formed his beliefs, and he's engaging in this activity that we're describing.
he's perceived things about humans in the case of the treatise of human nature, and he has decided, this is the way humans are, I will believe these things about humans, based on my observations. It's not really any different than a Catholic saying, this is who God is, these are the data streams, these are the authorities above me, I will believe that based on my observations. It's not even different from the St. Harris case, where he says, truth is the answer, you know, whatever he might say. He has based it on his perceptions of reality, and he's accepted that. He's rigid in those ways now.
What's interesting is all of these people appeal to some sort of outside system of authority. I mean, I guess Hume does. His outside system of authority is perhaps the fact that his perceptions give him the best possible thing he can get. He called them impressions.
Yeah.
The combination of passions and reason. Sam Harris maybe appeals to the authority of scientific mode of thought, which is a very difficult mode of thought to walk in, for sure. And then Christians appeal to this outside authority to some extent as well. You know, God, saints, martyrs, theologians, what have you. And I would like to point out that Christians, specifically the Catholics, point out to that and say that's an infallible source.
Mm.
When the Pope speaks ex cathedra, that's an infallible word from God.
Yeah.
Theologians, unless the Church proclaims them later, as they did with Augustine to some extent, as they did with some of Aquinas later on, it's infallible.
Yeah.
Is there any such thing? I mean, there's no such thing as certainty, right? Of any such authority?
I don't know. I'm not certain.
I don't see any certainty in any of these people, but people are talking as if they're certain. And if they're not certain, they don't speak at all. They don't speak until they are certain.
See,
people don't like to put themselves out there on the grounds of probabilities.
But this is what we're talking about. We're saying that they become certain based on their observations, which are intrinsically
flawed,
uncertainable, like they're unverifiable. They're limited.
That's
they're very limited.
I really like the Baconian approach, which is this: the senses judge of the experiment. So let's just take one of these up and take it apart for a second. I will argue for Bacon. I think that the senses are very flawed, so let them just judge of the experiment. But as we've already discussed, what's the problem with this? The experiment has to be formed based on what?
I mean,
human perception.
Yeah.
Human ideas.
Well, I mean, we've talked about this in many past podcasts.
Like
okay, so we try and repeat it over and over again.
Oh, yeah. We don't even know if the science that we're doing is correct because the experiment we formed is based upon all of these
things. Some cases, there aren't even proper verification measures in place to replicate certain, you know, many studies get done one time, and then those results get published and we believe them as science, and it taints the very name of science. There's fundamentally a limit to how much work we can do. And so we want to branch out. We want to do all this stuff. We want to try all of these different ideas out and do scientific work on all of them. But in many cases, an individual only performs that work. And that individual may have erred. May have, you know, maybe their senses were off.
So that's science.
In some way or another. I mean, that's a basic way of talking about it. We've talked about this in more length.
Method,
yeah.
Deductive method. We've already dealt with that to some extent.
Yes.
So then the other method is first principles. You know, instead of inductively, you deductively do it.
Right.
I still really think that if you do that well, you can get to a point where the leap over that existential beyond is not this massive gap. I still really believe that.
Yeah.
I really have some faith in human reason.
And we've discussed this to length as well. It's a harder task because you will find in going down this road, there are parts, there are components that you are still limited by your own experiences on. In order to go down this road and find these first principles, you kind of have to have some faith in some very specific things in order to get very far. What actual bases are you going to use is what I'm referring to. And determining those that's the hard part.
Well, for me, what seems to be, and I say for me because, you know, in this, the spirit of this conversation, that seems to be the only right thing to say. For me, if then else, that one thing we got at, if there is an eternal state,
yeah,
and all of life should be spent making it good, else eternal suffering.
Yep.
That is not a certainty.
No.
That is not a perfectly verifiable statement. But it's almost as if the best thing that does is it throws a question into
yeah.
the mix. And
it opens
the
door.
That question kind of lingers, and then people have to make decisions.
Right.
But at the very least, we've brought people very far along the road just with that one question.
I think that's true. Its basis is still a problem. Its basis is still where do we get those if then else ideas from? You know?
Yeah.
It could be that we have no grounds for ifing an eternal state.
Hmm. And that's one of Hume's arguments, is that he says that these things are not based on directly experienced phenomena, therefore there's no point and no right to do any sort of ifing, thening, and elsing about them.
Yeah.
But see, that's such an arbitrary statement, and that's something that needs to be pushed back against. That's one of the things that has made positive perspectives somewhat nihilistic, is because we're like, all of these bases are
bad,
so why why view them at all? And the whole perception discussion has rendered us groundless. And that's why I think in the first episode we really pushed so hard for the ifing, thening, and elsing, so to speak. Because we were really hoping we could get to something solid, anything solid. Even if it's not much, but just a little strip of land.
In later book club episodes, I tried to get us to a place where we could agree about the concept of truth. This is something we briefly talked about in the last episode, and
we will talk about
a lot more. Yeah, my goal there, even my conclusions for that are fairly limited, because our actual knowledge of truth, in a metaphysical sense, is limited, because we're flawed beings. We're not perfect, you know, data machines.
Hmm.
So even that doesn't get us anywhere on a human personal level. But it does get us to an agreement about what truth is. And it does get us to that place where we can say, okay, at least we acknowledge the same problems.
And that could be something that, you know, Hume has said. You know, Hume at least brings us to the point that we are not perfect, reasoning, rational data machines. Your impressions, his word for perception, your impressions are combined from your reasoning faculties and your passionate emotional faculties. Both of those things come together to create the composite that is presented to your mind. So I see a lot of similarities there between Hume, and that probably gives you a preview of things to come.
Yeah.
And things I'm going to say.
All right.
So in summary, Hume begins to inject some of this feeling of nihilism. Because we're beginning to feel there's no ground to stand on when you live in an empiricist world.
Yeah.
And I've tried to push back against that as much as I can. I still don't admit of agreement on this being so impossible. And
yeah.
I don't know.
We'll continue on this theme. This is a very difficult question. It's something we all need to struggle with and talk about, think about. Kind of on a parallel idea, I wanted to bring up this question relating these kind of imperial structures, this sort of science-producing model concept that Hume does and much of science does. I mean, just to bring it down to really understandable terms for everyone, whenever you open a textbook, you see this. You see, this is like this, and this has four subcomponents, and here they are. Literally every textbook ever says, this is this way, and this is this way. They follow Hume's model, basically.
Oh, that's interesting.
I mean, I'm sure you've noticed that.
I hadn't noticed until you pointed it out just now.
I mean, I could actually pull out any textbook in the world and, and point that out to you. To be fair, I think there was one
once that I saw that was less structured. But so, that was from a computer scientist who was a genius. So, you know, props to them. But
I mean, yeah, I've seen that. But it's so funny is that's almost even before Hume as well, because you see Aristotle and his...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's
rhetoric,
the same idea.
He says the three things that political rhetoricians argue of is ways, means, and ends.
And there's only three things, you know. This is the only way to categorize it. Okay. We understand this is a model. I'm pushing back against it. It's extraneous structure, all of that. My question, though, is given this concept of scientific observation producing models, which is like most of science, I hope it's not, but it's probably true. Is there ever, can we conceive of some sort of model that actually is either philosophically grounded, and this is an either or inclusive of the breadth that it claims, inclusive of the topic that it wants to actually discuss?
Almost a unified theory of trueness.
So either this model has to actually represent the reality, or it has to be philosophically grounded and thereby represent the reality.
I would say that that could exist, but it would never be something that could be applied.
Oh, wow. So why? Would it be too complicated? What would it be?
It would be so broad and so general.
I mean, we are talking about in a specific field or a subfield.
Okay,
so
science. In science specifically.
Yeah,
okay,
so right, imagine, right. You know, we're studying anthropology and we want to, like Hume does, describe what humans are.
I would only,
in some sense.
If I agree to this empirical truth, I would only be able to say that I'm able to describe correctly the data stream I'm getting of human X in human country X.
But when you say data stream,
X time.
Yeah, you're linking it back to an actual instantiation, which is, does not fulfill either my or my other, I guess.
That's fine.
Of being metaphysically, well, not metaphysically, philosophically grounded. It doesn't fulfill that because it's only an instantiation. And it doesn't fulfill this idea of actually including the breadth of reality.
Well, if it's separate from instantiations, it would have to be metaphysical.
Okay, so perhaps in the metaphysical realms we could. And this is also where we see these absurd arbitrary models. We talked about
this
a couple podcasts ago.
Which is what Hume is doing. This all seems to be metaphysical to me, what Hume is doing. I mean, to say that passions exist, you don't observe passions, you don't do experiments on passions, but you see their effects like the wind. So I think I may be satisfied with one of your ends of your claim, that it is possible to do a philosophical grounding thing, but for that to happen, it seems to be a metaphysical thing, not anything related to science.
Okay, so let's think about metaphysics. And I think that would be fine. It doesn't have to be related to science. Let's think about metaphysics. When we did an episode, two or three episodes ago, we talked about Duns Scotus. We talked about metaphysics from Aristotle.
Yeah.
Each of them had these arbitrary systems that we're kind of pushing back on now.
Hmm.
Duns Scotus listed out all of these...
10 words or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, accidents related to, you know, these fundamental things. You can go back and listen to episode 9 if you want more on that. My point is, it was an arbitrary model that didn't actually fulfill my requirements of being philosophically grounded. Because when he listed each accident, he didn't say, and here's why this is an actual thing. Here's why this is a real metaphysical reality. Or here's why this... I mean, accidents aren't real metaphysical realities. I shouldn't say that. Sorry to my keen listeners. I'm contradicting myself from 3 episodes ago.
No, it's fine. This is tough stuff to think about.
It's hard to even use the right word. And we address this when we talk about metaphysics. It's extremely hard to find the right words.
About metaphysical things with physical language.
Yeah.
physical symbols.
But I you probably get the idea. You fall off the train pretty quickly when you assert that this is a metaphysical thing. And don't have any reason to say that this is specifically a metaphysical thing. As soon as you specify, you're not linking it to...
What about this?
Reality.
Philosophical concept of words.
Okay.
I just realized, as I said what I just said just now.
Sure.
Words are not physical.
Okay, let's
even
work.
Even when they're on the page.
Yes.
The words themselves are nothing.
Yes.
They're images.
Okay, so
of a thing that has a mathematical reality. But even that mathematical reality, the word is attempting to get at the ideal form of whatever it's speaking about.
Okay, so now we're talking about a model that includes an ideal form.
So I'm saying the only model I can really think of would be somewhere between linguistics and...
Information theory or something?
Yeah. I don't know. That's the only thing I can say that admits of being on the border between metaphysical and physical.
Yeah.
Those are the only things I can see that are there. I know that we could say, in the words of one famous philosopher, data. But what if data is too purely metaphysical and doesn't come close enough into the real world to be this unifying thing?
Wow.
And this is just me, like...
I'm, like, physically excited by this conversation. I just want to say that.
So the words seem to attempt to give a shadow of all of the Platonic cognitive framework at once.
Okay.
It's an image.
Yeah.
It's a picture. It tries to describe a mathematical reality.
Okay.
It attempts to go beyond the divided line to talk about... what's the next thing? Or no. There's four things. Images, then what's right after that?
Physical instantiations.
It tells of a physical instantiation.
Well, the word itself, when you use a word,
is
that
instantiation.
It has that specific use. Yeah.
Talks about a mathematical reality. Like whenever I talk about a chair... Or whenever I talk about
it
past
has
the
a,
podcast.
It has that transcendent meaning, referring to something, metaphysical.
So I'm talking about past podcasts, and I'm referring to something that has a mathematical place in time, a mathematical schematic, right, a computer science-y schematic. And then also, inherent in the word is the idea that
it's
something
form.
About that needs to be a certain level of perfection to even be worth putting into words.
Having a word for it.
Yeah.
This is tough because we're using a model that might be arbitrary in order to describe language as... See, I want to say language is a fundamental, so I kind of want to agree with you. I want to say communication is there, almost as a fulfillment, a model which fulfills my sort of requirements. But at the same time, we're using a model that doesn't fulfill my requirements in order to try and show that this
and it doesn't fulfill
generic...
your requirements. Why?
Well, I don't think the Platonic cognitive framework is not philosophically grounded in my sense. In the modern sense.
True.
Because it doesn't link back to fundamentals. It is something that Plato pulled out of his ass and said, here's how things work. Right? And that's what we're pushing back against.
But is there anything better than what Plato pulled out?
Is there anything better than what Hume pulled out?
Oh, very many things.
But you see my point, right? When we try and describe a system, when we try and describe anthropology or metaphysics or something, we're just using models to do that.
Yeah.
And they're limiting.
And that's the interesting thing about words.
And
so
I kind of want to go there with you, with linguistics, to say, okay, maybe there is some sort of concept behind linguistics that actually is philosophically grounded or properly...
And metaphysically.
Fully answers the breadth of the scope that it's trying to do.
Yeah.
But I don't think that we've given adequate... description of that.
Something, and that was an idea that literally just fell into my mind as we were sitting here. We probably need to think more about that.
Could be.
Because that just now hit me. What if words are the things that are on the boundaries of metaphysical and physical, and somehow are the only things that bring all of this together in a unified, univocatus whole?
Yeah.
Because if you don't have words, you just have chaos. That's why, in the beginning, if you're thinking of this from a purely scholastic perspective, what is Adam doing to bring order? He's giving names.
Naming. And God's speech brings structure and order.
Logos.
Yeah. Back
now
to Logos.
This is another layer down. Maybe Logos is the ideal form. And now it's arbitrary structure. Here we go. Arbitrary structure. Logos is the ideal form. Then underneath Logos, we have...
I really don't know where you're going.
Logos is the good. Logos is
okay.
The fifth and up at the good.
Oh, I got you. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. But it's worth more discussion because I want to hear what you have to say later on. But back to Hume.
What? We've been talking about him this whole time. What do you mean?
That's true. We have been talking about Hume. But the whole point here is that we would not be able to have this discussion if we didn't agree to a rule book.
Yeah.
And we have some sort of rule book. You know, maybe some of our rules are different. Some of our kingdoms of being play by different rules. But we agree to a common epistemology. We're okay with challenging our own assumptions, I would hope, to some degree.
Yeah.
And I think perception could be a powerful tool as long as it goes beyond perception. I think it can. I think words right away are going beyond perception. Now, maybe, yes, they're based on perception, but does that mean that perception is the end-all to be-all, the final say? No, because you can compare words. You can compare the values of words and the actions that words speak of and the realities words speak of, and you can tell pretty quickly when Hitler writes in Mein Kampf and you compare that to the writings of, say, a Churchill, I would hope it would be obvious what's better. Gassing Jews? This is a hilariously, not hilarious in the sense that the tragedy of what he did was hilarious, but it's a ridiculously extreme example. But still,
well,
the words admit of the value of each of their perceptions.
Each instantiation of a word conveys an idea to each listener separately. To each person who says it as a receiver or sender of it, and each person who receives it as a participant in that conversation. So when we're talking about words, we have an extremely hard time trying to work how in the world they could have any sort of meaning at all, because it's a communally agreed upon thing.
But the thing is, we know for a fact that they must have a deep metaphysical meaning or some sort of grounding, because look what the German nation was galvanized to do on the basis of the galvanization that happened from the words.
It's the ideas behind the words that does the galvanization, in my mind.
But the words are the currency of exchange.
Yes, absolutely. Right. Yeah. So, almost like a paper dollar bill has value, it is communally agreed upon that it has value.
The idea is trust in the American ethic.
You have some basis for having that value.
Yeah.
In the case of words, it's some sort of implicit, not even a well-defined, but just something that everyone using their minds agrees on. Now, we could say, okay, the dictionary is the basis and all that. I don't think that's true. Dictionary is a reference point in order to solve a certain problem when you have disagreements about words.
And this is why I think we just hit it. Words. Narratives are somewhere in there.
Narratives is beyond. Yeah, narrative conveys idea both through words and through story. We'll talk more about narratives, of course,
in the next episode. In
every episode.
Stay tuned, folks. Narrative is about to get a massive day in the sun.
I think we'll leave it there. I think we'll say, let's consider what the meaning of language itself is. Let's consider if this is getting at some sort of philosophically grounded model that we can all agree upon as reality. That's really what we want to see. We want that king on a hill to declare truth, like you pointed out earlier.
Yeah.
We would even like for Hume in his anthropological understandings to be right, because we could look at him and say, wow, we all agree, we understand this is truth.
We'll talk more about truth as we go on. We'll talk more about words as we go on. For now, thank you for listening. Keep thinking these great questions with us. This has been Narratives in Philosophy. Signing off.